Well, good morning and welcome to the second in our series of Many Faiths Doing Justice. Before we start on this morning's, I just want to remind you that we have one more in this series next week. Ala Mohammed from the Islamic Center of Pittsburgh will be here, and her topic will be social justice, the backbone of Islam. Today, we're going to look at social justice in Judaism. And some of you may already know our speaker, who is Karen Hochberg, who's been with us any number of times as part of our Jewish-Christian dialogue. So she has a long history of being involved in things that care for people and ask for justice. She is a former director of the Pittsburgh Area Jewish Council. She is a Pepperdine and Carlow University graduate. She helped with the Greater Pittsburgh Interfaith Coalition. She's a graduate leadership member of Pittsburgh. She was on boards. I mean, this list goes on, and I probably won't read them all, but many, 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 many places where Karen has been engaged in interfaith activity and social justice work. I will say that the thing I remember about Karen most was her tackling probably the most intractable issue of our time. One of the meetings of the Jewish-Christian Dialogue, she laid out in a very clear manner four ways of looking at the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And most of all, what she did on that day was to help us to see the various ways that people can view this. And I think that's a great strength that she has, helping us to see the other person's point of view. And as we work for social justice, this is really important. So I am really excited to have her here. Before I give her the microphone, I would just like to open with prayer. God of us all, we thank you for bringing us together to address issues of concern to you and concern to us. We thank you for giving us the strength and energy and skills to address these issues. We particularly thank you for Karen, who has been engaged in this work for many years. We ask you to give voice to her concerns and to allow us to work with her. We thank you again for the bringing us together. Amen.
All right. Good afternoon or good morning.
Good morning.
Congratulations on being here in the summer in June. This is impressive. We probably could not get this at Road of Shalom. This many people. So hats off. That's one of the challenges we face because one of the things I want to lay out today is, you know, Bobby asked me to speak to you about what inspires me about social justice. And I was raised a Catholic and converted to Judaism later in life. And I think a foundation in faith from my parents and understanding the importance of faith made me the person that I am. And how we approach faith through different lenses and how we apply what we believe as we age and learn more through a faith lens is very, very important. So today I'm going to talk to you about social justice through the lens of Reform Judaism and the landscape of Judaism in America about social justice, because we Jews right now in America are quite comfortable. I mean, the Pew surveys show that we're widely respected. We've certainly become a large part of society. Jews in America have more influence in government and politics and the civic fabric of life than we have ever had in the entire history of our faith. So I'm going to talk to you about a rabbi who served, a little bit about a rabbi who served Road of Shalom congregation at the turn of the century. And the way that I view social justice is through Rabbi J. Leonard Levy's lens. He was born in England. He came to America in the mid, about 1870, started on the West Coast, but served in Philadelphia and landed in Pittsburgh. And the way that I got inspired to learn about Rabbi Levy was that I read in one of our bulletins that as a result of J. Leonard Levy's life, J. Leonard Levy's faith expressed itself in these results: that Jews were prouder, that men were kinder, and God was nearer. And I thought, wow, if someone lived a life like that, who is this rabbi? I mean, I knew of Levy Hall. There was a photo of him with a priest collar on, because that's how rabbis at the turn of the century. He served Pittsburgh from 1901 to 1917. And while he was often preaching against creeds and dogmas, at one point his congregation asked him in 1906 that he wrote this, and I have some copies if you want, about his faith. He said, "My religion is based upon the acceptance of the eternal God as my Father, upon the treatment of my fellow man as my brother, to work in hope, to accept the past in gratefulness, to strive to add to the good for the future, to be honest in all my dealings and expressions, to worship the truth, to be loyal to my country and to my ideals, to seek salvation through character, to treasure the truth of Scripture, to labor to advance Israel's purpose." And in this case, it was Judaism, because Israel in 1906 did not exist. So when he spoke of Jews, he spoke of Israel. "To do justice, to love mercy, to walk humbly before God, and to live that I may die regretted, to die in the faith that I may live after death. This is my religion." So when he passed away, J. Leonard Levy died very young, actually. At 52, there was a pneumonia epidemic, and he succumbed to pneumonia at age 52. It was a great loss to the city, because Levy was involved as a Jew at the turn of the century in the civic fabric of Pittsburgh in many ways. 10,000 people lined the streets, and when Levy died, Stephen Weiss came from New York, because Levy was a renowned orator, and he really helped establish the concept of Reform Judaism. You have to remember, in 1900, and Reform Judaism is a way into Judaism, not that people will say it's like, we Reform Jews pick what we want to do. We, you know, there's no mandates that you must be kosher, or there's no mandates that you should keep Shabbat. It was a way of looking at Judaism through an ethical, intellectual lens. And at the time Levy came here, there were no prayer books, there were no services written. He really helped to establish the largest presence of Reform Judaism in Western Pennsylvania. He also was quite the community organizer, which is another strain of looking at social justice in today's age. We really need to understand how to be community organizers and how to foster collaboration. So Levy, throughout Western Pennsylvania, worked in Ambridge and small towns that had a rabbi to start to begin to share resources about Reform Judaism. But the one takeaway that I want you to think about of Reform Judaism is J. Leonard Levy, in many of his sermons, often talked lovingly. He fully was Shomar Shabbos. He kept Sabbath. He encouraged the congregants to do that. But the idea that you take on Jewish practice out of a sense of not duty, but out of a sense of beauty, and you're bringing this into life to glorify God because you're accepting that practice, not because someone is mandating that you keep Shabbat, not somebody is mandating to be kosher or to adopt these practices. Reform Jews believe that we take on these practices because they become a part of us in the way that we worship God, not because we're commanded to do so. So that was the kind of the strain of Judaism that brought to the community. But the two things that I like best about my research about Levy is there are two. He often spoke of character, what it meant to be a person of character. And courage and capacity, J. Leonard Levy had much of that. He was the first Jew to speak from a Christian pulpit on a Sunday, during a Sunday service in the early 1900s. He was fostering interfaith dialogue when Jews were not so well liked in the community. And he was often admonishing his congregants. J. Leonard Levy started a series of Sunday sermons, which back then was quite controversial, because the congregation still practiced Shabbat services on Saturday. But on Sundays, because the men worked, they were often merchants or worked in the mills, and a lot of Rodef Shalom members owned the mills, like the Levinsons were part of our congregation back then. But he would often admonish his congregants, you want respect, you want honor, you want to be considered among the helpful and uplifting influence in Pittsburgh. Levy said to them, you can have it. You must pay the price, not necessarily in money, but certainly in character and service to the community. So J. Leonard Levy often wanted his congregants to be involved in the civic fabric of life, and his theory was you can't buy your way into respect, that as a Jew, you have a duty to live and establish a set of character to be well-regarded in the community. So like I said, he had immense capacity. And you know, if you want to affect change today, we're all marching, right? We're all watching TV. It takes a lot of energy to be involved in social justice. It takes a lot of energy to want to get out of your house and attend an interfaith dialogue when you work or you could be with your grandchildren. So it takes a capacity and a commitment to really be involved in social change. So I talked a lot about some of the things that Levy has done. But Dr. Jacob, who's our rabbi emeritus, said this about Levy. We just celebrated the 100th anniversary of his death about 2 months ago at Rodef Shalom. But Dr. Jacob in 1967 said this about J. Leonard Levy. Levy linked new ideas to an ancient faith, so brought our entire community into the 20th century. He built a bridge across which generations have walked. He built it for us, and he built it for them, for the community. So now we're in the throes of the 21st century, right? What kind of bridges are we going to build? And where are we in this idea of social justice in the Jewish landscape? Because as I mentioned when I started out, Jews are quite comfortable now. In fact, maybe it's time more to afflict the comfortable Jews. I think we would say that on many levels, and I think probably in this church as well. This is a beautiful community, and we can always do more. And one of the things that I worry about right now is civility and our ability to hear each other across bridges and across ideas and across concepts, because right now, as many of the polling data shows, we're quite divided, and I don't know how to walk that bridge. So when Levy died, even though he was quite influential, he requested that his funeral be quite simple. No eulogies were to be given. And on his tombstone, it reads, he strove to be a teacher of God's word and to live it, which is quite simple. And he did, because his legacy, here I am talking about him almost 100 years after his death and the influence that he brought to Pittsburgh and how he helped to establish Reform Judaism and the respect of Jews in Western Pennsylvania. So let's talk a little bit about the Jewish American landscape today. Reform Judaism really had a large emphasis on learning. Jews love learning. I think, you know, we do. It's a huge part of Jewish DNA, as well as social justice. So today in Jewish America, we have the Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform movements. And in the Orthodox movement, we have Modern Orthodox, which is Rabbi Lord Sacks, and there's a lot of prominent rabbis in New York. Rabbi Sacks is wonderful. I'll quote him later. And here in Pittsburgh, we have the Chabad movement, and there's a strong movement. Have you used Chabad of South Hills, or is anybody familiar? Chabad is a very orthodox sect of Judaism, not as right-wing as some of the sects in Israel, which is a conversation that we can touch upon briefly. But Chabad is a movement that was inspired by Rabbi Schneerson, and it's all about, it comes out of the mystical tradition of Judaism, and it's really quite beautiful. And what Chabad rabbis and Chabad rebbetzins are good at, better than I've seen in any denomination, is the ability to make people feel welcome and comfortable and engage them in wanting to learn one small thing about Judaism. You'll see Chabad trying to strap to fill in on people in a mall. They'll do open shop Judaism. But in some ways, I've been invited to the Chabad rabbi's wife in Squirrel Hill to Shabbat at their house. And I will tell you, it is beautiful. It's special. And Hani Altine does a musical program for women every year. And she has the ability to connect Reform Orthodox, conservative Jews in a very special way. And it's something to be aware of. And so if you ever want to explore Judaism in South Hills beyond Rabbi Mahler and Rabbi Greenbaum synagogues, Chabad is very interesting, and you will learn about Judaism, and they are part of the Orthodox movement, so I wanted you to be aware of them. Now, Orthodox Judaism, I think, spends less time on, not that they don't believe in social justice, but I think it is not a primary emphasis of Orthodox Judaism. Orthodox Judaism is about observance. It's about small, insular community more so. So they don't spend as much time. Now, the conservative movement and the reform movement, there's a heavier emphasis. The conservative movement, which is the Jewish Theological Seminary, trains their rabbis. And you can see that underneath there's prominently displayed tzedek, which means justice, social justice. And you can see some of the issues that they're working on. It's kind of far from your seat. And civil rights, economic justice, empowerment, LGBT, healthcare. This is the agenda of the conservative movement, and you can find this on their website, the Reform Movement. And in each of these categories, you can learn about what the Reform Movement believes about advocating for those particular social justice issues. Now, the Reform Movement, of which I'm a member, they train their rabbis through Hebrew Union College. And the Reform Movement, because this is such a pillar of Reform Judaism, we have a very influential arm of Reform Judaism called the Religious Action Center, the RAC, they call it. Now, it's wonderful. Rabbi David Saperstein, who's a very prominent American Jew, has set the social justice agenda for a long time. He retired 2 years ago because he went to work, I believe, maybe 4 years ago. He worked for Obama in the State Department as the Jewish outreach liaison. So he gave up the RAC, and Rabbi Jonah Pesner runs it now. So right now, the Reform Movement is very engaged in the healthcare advocacy debate. They're encouraging, our Reform Jews to call legislators. And criminal justice reform. In fact, when I worked at PAJC, one of the programs that I put together was this idea of mass incarceration. It's one of the items that the Reform Movement is looking at now. The idea of the disparate number of African Americans that are jailed compared to whites, and the idea of, are we over-incarcerating, and have we basically continued? We brought in Brian Stevenson, who wrote a book called Just Mercy. Have you talked about it here? It's an amazing book. He's an amazing speaker, and he makes some very valid points. And Brian started the Equal Justice Initiative to raise awareness in the South about, recently a monument was removed, some of the Southern monuments to Civil War luminaries have been taken down because of the idea of what signal does that send to someone who is an African American living in the South. But that's only a small part of what he does. Brian is a death penalty lawyer, and so we started to look at this idea of how do we advocate for sentencing reform, and what are we going to do when people come out of these prisons? What is our duty to train people so that there's less recidivism? So that's a big agenda of the Reform Movement now. But the Religious Action Center does quite a bit of social justice work, and Rabbi Pesner goes around the country, and you can find out the agenda, the other items that they're working on, simply by going to rac.org. So that's kind of what's happening in the Jewish world. But really, I think that a point that we have to talk about is that in the 60s, I think a lot of social justice emanates from faith, right? I don't think we would have had the civil rights movement if we didn't have Martin Luther King and the people, the church, the Christians, the Jews, and the black church that joined him in forming that nonviolence resistance to get the Civil Rights Act passed. So I think that one of the things that has happened in Judaism, as Jews became more comfortable and Israel was established, a lot of the advocacy or a lot of the capacity of Jews, the focus was placed on Israel and the protection of Israel. And not that social justice didn't exist or there wasn't efforts once the civil rights and voting rights were passed, I think Jews spent a lot of time trying to protect Israel. You know, you had the Holocaust, you had the idea of how do we resettle and help Israel grow as a nation. And I don't know how many of you visited, how many have been to Israel? Did you went on the trip with Reverend Gilchrist? I mean, it is absolutely amazing to see what has happened there since Israel became a state. But it's also very apparent when you're in Israel, the disparity among the population, right? So one of the biggest conversations in the Jewish community is declaring Israel as a Jewish state. That's a hang up in the negotiations, right? But Israel wants it to be known that it's a Jewish state because the narrative on the Palestinian side is that Jews don't have a right to be there. But we have the history that shows that Jews did live in the land and were expelled for many years. So that is a diplomatic nightmare. But the other thing that I want to talk about is even in Judaism right now, especially among Reform Jews, Reform Jews are having quite a problem because the Netanyahu administration negotiated the ability for men and women to pray at a part of the Western Wall, right? It was negotiated, and then the head rabbi pulled it back, and in order for Netanyahu to keep his government together, they disband the plan because women cannot pray. Reform Jews, we pray with men and women together, right? Conservative Jews pray with men and women together. Orthodox, there's the mechitza where it separates men and women. And at the Western Wall, there used to be a larger place for women to pray. So men have been encroaching on the place for women for a long time. So they negotiated this idea, and it's been reneged upon. And the Reform movement is very concerned about this, and there's efforts underway for Reform Jews not to fly Al-Al. You know, now you start to get into this idea of, you know, boycott, divestiture, and sanctions. You know, not that Reform Jews would ever, I don't think that that's the way to bring peace to the Middle East. I don't support organizations that support that because that just shuts down dialogue on the side of the house. But we do have much conflict right now in the Jewish community about this idea of praying in the Western Wall. So when you're working with Jews, as Bobby pointed out, we were talking before, you have, when Jews are in the room, you have two Jews, there's at least more than three opinions. Right? This is like a common joke, but it is very true. We will parse a concept many, many different ways, and often there isn't consensus, but there's this idea of respecting other people's ideas. So Israel, in American social justice, has really taken a lot of the focus and energy of American Jews. But now here we are in 2012, and there are agendas among citizens that certainly Reform Jews are worried about. Like, we're worried about freedom of the press. We're worried about separation of church and state. We're worried about, because Jews have been able to thrive in a democracy, right? We were able to, in America, Jews were first elected to office. I mean, you never had agencies of Jews other than, actually holding elected office in the kind of concentration that we have in America. So it's a perilous time. And even among Jews, we have Jews who are just like you do, small business owners or Republicans. I mean, a lot of people think all the Jews are Democrats, right? That we're all liberals and we're Democrats. I'm here to tell you that's not true. Not true. We have divides within the Reform Jewish world, just as we do in America right now, about how to solve social issues. And the problem is becoming the civility and the idea of, you know, do you need to be right, or is there a third way to solve a problem? And that's kind of what Rabbi Sacks got at. And I think what the other thing that I'm seeing in the area of social justice is that TED Talks. You all know what TED Talks are, right? Do you ever listen to them? They're technology, education, design. They're wonderful. Up until this year, they did not really have religious leaders speak at TED conferences. There's this idea that social justice, that people want to kind of separate that concept. But this year, they had Pope Francis beamed in a talk, and then Lord Sacks spoke. And this is one of the things that he said. Religion can influence the tone and direction of public debate. It is said that when the king dies, his power ends, but when a prophet dies, his influence begins. And I'll circle this back to J. Leonard Levy. Those Sunday sermons always began with a quote from the prophets, and often Levy did sermons that really challenged his congregants. Many of them were business owners, and Levy preached from the pulpit about a living wage in the early 1900s. He talked about the idea of labor being the source of wealth in America, and that business owners, to whom much is given, much should be shared. And so he took on a lot of these issues about Rabbi Levy, even though he, you know, his daughter came home in the early 1900s, and the kids in the public schools were being required to sing hymns during Christmas. So J. Leonard Levy did a beautiful sermon before the school board about the separation of church and state. Not that he didn't think hymns were beautiful, because actually a lot of the hymns that Levy opened his Sunday sermons with were some of them were actual Christian hymns that he repurposed or rewrote in that original Sunday morning. And by 1917, over 1,200 people were attending these sermons every Sunday. They published the sermon. Kids from Pitt used to come. It was really one of the largest interfaith gatherings at Road of Shalom, where people came just to hear him speak. So I'm going to read a couple quotes from a sermon that Levy delivered. Then I'm going to open it up for us to talk. He did a sermon in 1906, December 30th, a Sunday lecture, he called The Making of an American. And what he said in 1906 was, America took 10,000 years to make. 10,000 years, if you will, 10,000 years were needed to bring it into being. In America, there is to be found all that is nonconformist in the world's religion, and all that is democratic in the world's ideals. Here, under the aegis of our flag, there live today in peace 80 millions of people who have forgotten to sing the Wacht und Rhein, who have willingly become indifferent to the stirring melody of La Marseillaise, who sing other words to the time of God Save the King, but who with united voice chant the hymn in gratitude and the prayer of hope of God Save America. So one of the things that Levy talked about is this idea of us he was in the middle of forging that melting pot, right? So often these sermons were about respecting the fact that you were a German, you were a Frenchman, he was a Brit. He was raised in England, and the idea of us coming together to create America was quite important to Levy. The American people will never be satisfied until civil, religious, and political liberty will be established, not only for the good of the American, but for the good of humanity. There is not a ship leaving an American harbor bearing a letter abroad with the face of one of our great presidents impressed upon the stamp, but bears to the world an evidence that Israel's eloquent words were called in righteousness. I have made thee for a covenant of all the peoples, for a light unto the nations, to open the blind eyes, to bring out the prisoners from the prison, and them that sit in darkness of the prison house. So Levy really believed that America, here we were in the 1900s, that we were a light to other nations, right? He was so happy that he lived in this country and wanted his congregants to love America so much that during his Passover, like I told you, when he showed up, he really wanted his congregants to do Shabbat at home, so he created a curriculum for that. He created his own Passover Seder, and one of the elements that he had his congregants place on that table, in addition to the traditional elements on the Seder plate, was a small American flag. And Levy's documentation in his Seder was a complete listing of history from the time of Philo through the Jews living in the diaspora, It was completely different than just the story of Moses taking the people out of Egypt. That certainly became a part of it. But Levy wanted his congregants to see themselves in the context of history. And I'll end with this quote. The American people not only love liberty and peace, but they love fair play. It is rare that a man is hooted in an American audience. No matter how unpopular be his message, the American people are willing to listen and to give a fair hearing to any man who brings a message. So here we are 100 years later. What do we feel about that? Not so much anymore, right? So in one of the questions that Bobby put to me was, what inspires my social justice? I think when I ran the PAJC, the Christian-Jewish dialogues were very important to me. And a lot of times the other thing that we have going on in America right now is this idea of who is truly the social justice warrior, right? The idea of intersectionality and whether that will eat us alive, right? Is my cause the same as your cause? And if we don't stand in common purpose, what will get done? We all know that all these causes are important, but I don't know that they all get accomplished at one time, you know? So this idea of, I've been exploring, I'll be totally honest with you, since the election, what it means to be a white woman in the social justice arena. Because I went to the Women's March. I had one of the crazy hats. Someone knitted for me. I wasn't crazy about the hat, but I wore it. I thought, I'll go along, right? But I did want to go down there. I don't particularly look good in hats. So I went to the march, and it was the first time I ever marched on Washington. So I was like, okay, I'm going to go down there. This is important to me. I felt very out of place in that march because I had to stand there and listen to Israel's ills from up on high. I had to listen to disparage the candidate that I voted for. And I'm like, wow, this isn't why I came here. I just came here because I wanted us to think about what this means to be an American and that to show that I'm concerned about what's happening. And so after exploring that, there's a local artist, and I know you all do a lot of work at your church in Homewood, right? Do you all know who Vanessa German is? Vanessa German is a brilliant African-American artist who is also a writer and a spoken word poet. You should bring her to your church. She's amazing. And she started, bought two houses in Homewood, and she has a project called The Art House, where kids were watching her create her sculptures. She does a lot of African-American power figures in her sculpture. And the kids would say to her, "Can I help?" So she ended up creating The Art House, and kids come there after school. Well, someone insulted Vanessa and said, "How dare you not go to Washington?" which made her very angry. So she started a writing workshop for women. And so I ended up going to this since February. We've been writing and exploring topics of social justice. And the whole idea that I've seen, and I was really angry because I thought, man, I'm this really nice white woman. This is what I thought. Like, I've really cared about all this stuff all these years, right? And now people are telling me that you're not doing this right, right? And I'm like, oh my gosh, I really need to take a look at that. So yes, in some respect, I was not doing this right, because it's not up to me as a white woman to go in and solve people's problems. It's up to me as a white woman to stand with people on justice issues and allow them to tell me how to help them solve their problem, not to rescue, not to think that I have answers, not to think the way that I do things. So that was quite an interesting exploration. And my daughter, I remember my daughter in college did a project on white privilege. She came home and she's like, "I'm doing a special subject with my professors at Chatham on white privilege." And I'm like, "I didn't raise a racist. What do you mean you need to do a project on white privilege?" She's like, "Oh, Mom, you don't know." She's like, "You know, you really need to wake up." And she's right. This whole idea of how we walk in the world, like, I, you know, the African-American women that I have met in 6 months in this writing workshop has allowed me to see, when you think of what African-American women confront in America with the idea that many of their relatives are incarcerated or that they know relatives who have been shot, they're working sometimes two jobs to raise a family, grandparents are raising, the social fabric of the African-American community has been disrupted in many ways by the public policy that well-intentioned white women and men have created and imposed on those communities. And we have to be open to conversations about that. And it's really difficult to sit there, especially, I'll be honest, I think that I'm like a smart, well-read. Again, when you start using the word well-intentioned, you have to stop and take a look at yourself. So this is where how I'm exploring social justice at the moment. What does that mean, and how can I be more effective? Because until we really explore systemic racism in America, until we sit there and are more willing to have conversations about what that means, and a lot of times we're all white, we were totally unaware, and it was not in a malicious way. So I'm learning every day to be less racist. And it's really hard to say, I'm not racist in a hateful way. I'm racist in an unconscious way. And so I think where I want to focus my, maybe I can make a pitch to Reverend Gilchrist. In Seattle, they have something called, it's ironic, there's a gentleman, and you might want to read his books. He wrote a book. His name is Eric Liu. Have you heard of him? Eric Liu. He's a Japanese-American whose parents were interned during World War II, but that's a small part of his story. He wrote a book called Gardens of Democracy, and he created something in Seattle called Civics University. They do a big program in Seattle every year called Citizens University. I would like to bring that to Pittsburgh. And the other thing that he started this year, he wrote a book, We're More Powerful Than We Think We Are. And it's all about how to be a community organizer right now and how people in our democracy though it may seem like we don't have it anymore, we do have the power. And it's a really wonderful book. And they started, it's very similar to what we're doing here. In Seattle, Eric Liu started Civic Sundays. And they do lectures, much like Levy did, on topics on Sundays in Seattle. And people are flocking to it. Even though we can't get people to come to temple or services, and the, you know, I'm sure while this is a wonderful representation, you probably all wish more people came on Sundays, right? It's a common cause through throughout religion in America. So this idea of bringing these civic Sundays, because I think the only way we're going to move forward is through dialogue and getting to know each other and hearing the experience of other people. So the more that we have the ability to set that table in a diverse way with voices from all over, the more, the stronger our country will become. So that's kind of my thing, and I'm open to any questions that you might have. And thank you for listening. Yes?
Something interesting, Karen, about when you went to Washington. It put me in mind of what happens today when a bill tries to get through Congress, is that, you know, they, there's so many things that sort of get attached to it that the original thought get lost. And I hadn't really thought about that happening in this whole domain that we're in.
Right.
But sounds, and I think it makes sense that a lot of that is happening. Other things sort of get tacked on.
Right.
Is there some way to tackle that, do you think?
I think some of the myth of them, I think some of
the,
repeat the question. Tell me your name, sir.
Bob.
Who?
Bob.
Bob asked this. He said, when I went to Washington, I was disappointed because I thought the pure intention of that march was to show common cause for democracy in America. And I went there, and I'm in the actual, it was inspiring on the subway to park like miles outside of D.C. to get out of your car and see thousands and thousands of women. It was just amazing. Some of the signs were exciting. The whole energy of being there was good. But the agenda of the people who had the microphone, right, it became very contentious. And people, women who didn't go, were called out. Vanessa German ended up hosting this writing club because someone said, how dare you not go? How dare you not be part of this? And she was quite angered by that because here you have a woman daily working with souls who, I mean, in the inner city, people are shot. You know, two blocks from the art house, people will lay dead on the street till the coroner comes, right? This is traumatic in African-American neighborhoods, not just for the people who are shot or the family members. This is traumatic for the neighbors who witness this. And these kids go to school with that trauma. And I, you know, so the idea, how do you solve that? I don't know. I think Americans think that there is a pure intention, right? I think that there people tend to think there's one right way to do it, right? And there isn't one right way to do it. I mean, I worked in government. The only effective government is that at the end of the day, not everybody's happy about the bill, right? Because then you know that there's some pain points all around, right? Right, right. And the only way you get to compromise is through understanding other people's points of view and not judging what we think about, like, it would be like me judging the billionaires, right? But do we have a problem with billionaires in America? Do they outsize influence our politics beyond us knowing because they own networks? Now they own polling companies that can actually target data down to a precinct level and send. Look, I worked in politics. I actually put commercials on the air. And I will tell you, I've sat in rooms with political consultants who recommended negative commercials to suppress voter turnout. That's a strategy. So negative ads in Facebook or negative ads on Twitter, people say, screw it, not doing it, not going to vote, right? And look at the amount of people who don't show up in our democracy. But I would say one of the things I'd love for all of us to do is not allow ourselves to become a victim of that. We should be encouraging our neighbors to vote, right? Right? We should walk around, even if we're not involved in the system, on election day and say, please vote. I don't care who you vote for, but I think as a citizen of America, we should want to see voter turnout at 90%. This past election, which is the primary, 17% of the people voted. We were picking judges. Those are the people who have impact on this idea of who gets incarcerated or how long they stay incarcerated, right? Mayors, local mayors, right? These are the most important elections, and Americans are too lazy to show up for it. So we've become complacent. We've been lulled by TV. I feel like I grew up with, like, you know, like Lucy, and like we love our TV, right? We love our sports, we love our TV, now we love our video games. So I think the way to solve this and to force compromise among the people that we elect is to show up and vote. And you know, you can find out if your neighbors vote. Here's a really interesting project. It's public information. You could go down to the county, look at your street, and look at the voting record of your neighbors, right? Or you could decide just to send a letter to the neighbors on your street. I am so excited. I'm going to go to vote. You know that 80% of the people, there's studies that show that if someone gets a postcard in the mail that says, you know, 70% of the people vote on your street, or 10% of the people vote on your street, it increases turnout on that street. So we need to embrace our civic duty again, and the number one duty is voting. So I think that would create pressure to have compromise, because otherwise, right now, I mean, you can see it with this healthcare bill, right? You know, it's hard to take away something that Obama gave, right? Do you know that there, and it's amazing to me that people don't realize that Obamacare is the Affordable Care Act? Now, we know that, but people in West Virginia who did not vote to keep Obamacare or to vote for the Democrat, we're enrolling people in the Affordable Care Act and didn't realize that they voted for someone who is now helping to cement the idea that it needs to be repealed, right? So maybe it does. I'm a Democrat. I don't really care. If Donald Trump and McConnell and Paul Ryan would come up with a plan that kept what was good about Obamacare, the fact that families weren't decimated by bankruptcy on a lifetime limit, or that as a pre-existing condition, people can get health care. Because we know insurance companies have no incentive but what? To make money. Not good news or bad news, that's their job, right? Not judging that. If I'm running an insurance company, my job is to maximize shareholder value. That could be I've been hearing that as an ethics discussion. I went to business school in 1970, and I had professors telling me that Americans' businesses did short-term gains and maximize shareholder values, and the only way to grow a better economy, the only way to have a better economy, was to do long-term planning. We all know what we need to do, but no one's willing to take the short-term gain to do the green energy or to invest. So what we need to do is have citizens say, saying, yeah, we'll take the, well, you know, we want these kinds of things. And, you know, I don't care, repeal it. Call it Trump care, call it Ryan care, but let's keep. How many of you kept your kids on your insurance till they were 26? That's a good thing, right? If your kids aren't established yet. So there are elements of that. It's not even about the subsidy, but what mandated, what got people upset about that was there was a mandate that you have to buy insurance, right? So you have libertarians saying, oh my gosh, how dare you tell me that I should buy insurance? But how does insurance work? Risk pools, right? You have to have healthy people and sick people together in order to spread the risk. So now, you know, the proposal on the table is Ted Cruz wants to allow a pool to come for healthy young people. And they're going to pay money not to even have the coverage now. When we go now, we can get the preventative care, which cuts costs later. That was also part of Obamacare, that insurance companies had to provide certain levels of care, right? Now, this is arcane stuff that I'm standing up here talking about. You think most people want to read this? Like, they're like, lights out. Reverend Gilchrist.
There's a question coming here. Bear with me a second.
Sure.
Set it up. It takes effort for people in relatively homogeneous suburban communities who are basically comfortable socioeconomically. It takes effort to pay attention to these things. It takes effort to go to home with, pay attention to stuff that isn't directly impinging on your personal life. And just by sheer inertia, it's hard for people to find time and energy to do that, even if they have the will.
Right.
In Christianity, in some circles, not here, but in some circles, in Christianity, there's this notion that religion is a sort of privatized, individualistic thing. It's between me and God. It's about individual salvation and so forth. The prophets, of course, come from the Old Testament, from the Hebrew Bible. My sense of Judaism is that it's inherently much more of a community-oriented religion, in the sense that it's about a people, Jewish people particularly, but other peoples in general. And so the inclination to make it just sort of my private thing about getting to heaven is less of a temptation in Judaism than in Christianity. So here's the question. Is that true? When you were with the PAGC, you went to a lot of congregations in Jewish congregations. Do you think that this sense of social consciousness and responsibility, however that plays out, whether you're Republican or Democrat, or, do you think that in the synagogues in the Pittsburgh area, that message, that responsibility to the community is a central part of our religion and our responsibility before God in Jewish congregations, perhaps in a way that's not always in Christian congregations?
I think in some respects, my opinion on that is a broad brushstroke. I think that in congregations, both Christian, Jewish, Muslim, it all depends upon who leads that congregation. Like you care about social justice. If a rabbi, certainly in Judaism, in our congregation, this idea of community is very important. But I think also, I would make the judgment that Christian communities, we don't have this concept of heaven, right? Jews, we're not doing, like Levi said now, whatever I'm doing now, I want to live a life of character so that I die regretted, that I was a teacher of God's word and I lived it. So he took God's word from the point of view, from the idea of how do I build community? How do I get people to be responsible for themselves and others and realize that Judaism, like Buddhism or Confucianism or Christianity, is just a technology to create a great person, I think. So I think that it depends on who your pastor is. And yes, the capacity to want to leave Upper St. Clair, I will tell you that Squirrel Hill struggles with this. We tried to do a Black Jewish dialogue with our congregation and Reverend Denise Welch's congregation on the north side. And white people always want to talk to Black people. We want to have a dialogue. This is the other, and I'm being judgmental here, and I'm just going to put it out there, right? We want to have a dialogue. Let's get together with some Black people and talk, right? Because we want to hear their stories. So we come, as a white person, to a couple conversations, right? You're asking people to relive painful experiences. They have to recall that they couldn't be served at that soda fountain. They have to recall that they couldn't drink from that fountain. They have to recall that they were called the N-word. That is psychological damage. And white people sitting in a room of dialogue, the idea is how do you have the dinner? How do you go into their community? How do you understand? So that is some really uncomfortable stuff. And it creates a high level of commitment and capacity to keep doing it. Yes, some progress gets made because maybe one person, white person, who is biased and doesn't realize it may go to a meeting and say, wow, I really never thought about it that way. I never thought about the fact that Pittsburgh is one of the most highly segregated communities in the country. I never realized that we have the highest infant mortality rate among black babies in Allegheny County. And the systems that need to be put in place to solve that are quite complex, not that it hasn't been worked on. There are statistics. If you want to find out the disparity in Allegheny County between blacks and whites in a real-world example, go on to the University of Pittsburgh Race and Justice Initiative. Every year they put out a report, right? Corporate leaders come. They say things are going to happen. I worked for a county commissioner from 1996 to 2000. And I had been out of the arena of politics until I got back into PAJC. I went to the release of that report some 15 years later. The numbers hadn't moved at all. It's going to take a compelling commitment from white Americans in this county in order to improve the lot of the African American community. And we just can't tell people, you know, you have the same opportunity as this person. Because that is diminishing even among white Americans. That's why we have fear in America. We are all challenged here to think about whether our grandchildren are going to be able to get the same kind of jobs that we got out of college, right? How many people are afraid that their kids are not going to do better than I did better than my parents, right? People in America have a legitimate fear because we've not grown the pie and the disparities are not creating the opportunities that used to be there. And we have legitimate fears. And so it's going to take ministers, it's going to take conversations, it's going to take compromise, and it's going to be really hard work. Unless we begin it, we're going to be in this morass that is not the vision of what Rabbi Levy was expressing 100 years ago. So I hope we're up to the task. Yeah. Yeah, she's very interesting. Her husband was so supportive of her work. You know, you read the story about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and that's the case in any family. You know, this idea. I mean, I will tell you, like I told you, I've been exploring who I am as a white woman. And I will tell you, you know, I've had some very interesting, in the 1980s, I worked for Hughes Aircraft Company. I worked my way through college. I've had very important jobs. I bought $5 million worth of software and met Bill Gates and had to figure out how to network PCs at a large defense plant. Never once did I stop to say, thank you, women of the 60s, right? I didn't want to be seen as a feminist. I wanted to be seen as someone who had the little bow blouse on that sat in the meetings. And I will tell you, I was not the type of woman that was evil to other women, right? But I was often one of the few women in those rooms. My ideas, I would put an idea out, and this is common among women, and actually women have a strategy for this now, millennials. I would say, I think we should try X, and here's how to get there. 45 minutes later, if a man said the same thing I said 45 minutes earlier, brilliant, brilliant, let's get that done. Now, I never spoke up in those meetings. I would sit there and go, I said that 45 minutes ago. Right? I would be thinking this, right? I'd go back to my office. I kept my mouth shut because why? I wanted to be promoted. I wanted to do better, you know. It's just the compromises that we make in order to move the ball down the field a little bit. But now I think we're becoming aware because maybe the pie is shrinking. What is the common cause? So now millennials in a meeting room, if there's more than one woman and someone expresses an idea, someone will repeat. The young woman will say, well, Karen said that or Mary said that. It is a complete strategy, a tactic in a meeting among young women to have a woman's voice heard at the table. Now, are men evilly doing this? Absolutely not. Are white men really bad people? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. But if I was a white guy now, I might be feeling the same pain that I felt as being called a well-intentioned white woman, right? So when we start to explore the motives behind why we're doing things and why people, if we're just willing to, like, 5 minutes think about why people might think that, right? And realize there's such beauty in the black communities that you will go into. And black people are like nurses. They're the ninjas of being able to survive. I guarantee you that if we were put to the challenge that some of our African American citizens face, we probably couldn't do as well because we don't have that down and dirty problem solving mentality that a nurse or someone who has to face that every day faces. So, like, if anything, my message to you today is we need to be more aware of our motivations, and we need to really encourage people to vote. I don't care who you vote for. I want to see higher voter turnout. And be civically engaged, and make sure your grandkids are, right? Start incentives for voting. I mean, probably in this church, because you're here, your family probably votes. But encourage people who say, ah, doesn't matter. Explain why it does.
It matters at the
lowest level. And mostly at the lowest level. So thank you all for listening to me preach.